Welcome to History in a Year, America's first 250 years.
Join us every single day as we journey from the Revolution of 1776 to the 250th anniversary of the United States.
You can find every episode and join the discussion at pointedwords.com. I'm Stephen.
And I'm Leah.
It is February 25th. Welcome to episode 56. Over the last few episodes, we've been completely absorbed in the political drama of the year 1800.
We saw Thomas Jefferson running for president, fighting against John Adams and the Sedition Act. Jefferson was constantly talking about the Tree of Liberty and fighting against tyranny.
But while the politicians were writing pamphlets and making speeches about liberty in Philadelphia and Washington, D.C., there was a completely different conversation happening in the taverns and on the plantations of Virginia.
Because when you spend 25 years loudly telling the world that all men are created equal, and that rebellion against tyranny is a divine right, eventually, the people you are keeping in chains are going to start agreeing with you.
This brings us to one of the most remarkable and terrifying figures for the Southern planter class in the year 1800, a man named Gabriel.
You will often see him referred to in history books as Gabriel Prosser, taking the last name of his enslaver, Thomas Prosser. But he never used that name himself. To his followers, he was simply Gabriel.
Gabriel was born around 1776, the year of the Declaration of Independence. And his life was very different from the typical field hand working in the tobacco rows.
Gabriel was a blacksmith. And in the economy of the 18th century South, being an enslaved artisan gave you a unique kind of mobility.
His enslaver, Thomas Prosser, would hire him out. This meant Gabriel could leave his home plantation, Brookfield, and travel into the city of Richmond to do ironwork for other businesses. Prosser would take most of the money, but Gabriel was allowed to keep a small percentage.
This meant Gabriel was interacting with everyone. He was talking to white laborers, free black sailors, and other enslaved artisans. He heard the news coming in on the ships. He was fully plugged in to the political current of the world.
It was also physically imposing. Records describe him as a massive man, standing 6 feet 2 or 3 inches tall, which was huge for the 18th century. He had 2 missing front teeth and scars on his head from a fight with a white overseer, a fight where Gabriel bit off a chunk of the overseer's ear.
Gabriel was literate. He read the Bible, deeply inspired by the story of the Israelites escaping slavery in Egypt. But he was also reading the news.
And the biggest news of the 1790s was the Haitian Revolution. A few hundred miles to the south, the enslaved people of Saint-Domingue had risen up, killed their enslavers, defeated the French army, and declared themselves a free republic.
Gabriel looked at Haiti, and he looked at the American Revolution, and he decided it was time for Virginia to have its own reckoning.
In the spring of 1800, Gabriel started organizing. And the scale of his conspiracy is absolutely mind-boggling, especially considering it was done entirely in secret, right under the noses of the white authorities.
He recruited his brothers, Solomon and Martin. He recruited other blacksmiths to start quietly turning scythes and farm tools into swords and bayonets. He recruited enslaved men from across multiple counties, using Sunday church gatherings and barbecues as cover for their planning meetings.
The plan was highly tactical. This wasn't going to be a random, chaotic riot. It was a military strike.
The target was the capital of Virginia, Richmond. At the time, Richmond was a relatively small city of about 6,000 people, roughly half of whom were black.
The strike was set for the night of Saturday, August 30th, 1800. The plan was to gather a force of over 1,000 armed men just outside the city.
They were going to split into 3 columns. The first column would set a diversionary fire in the warehouse district to draw the white citizens away. The second column would capture the city's armory, securing thousands of muskets and barrels of gunpowder.
And the third column, led by Gabriel himself, would march directly on the governor's mansion. They were going to take the governor of Virginia hostage.
And the governor of Virginia in 1800 was none other than James Monroe, the future president of the United States.
Gabriel's plan was to hold Monroe at gunpoint and force him to agree to political demands. They wanted the abolition of slavery in Virginia, and they wanted a fair distribution of the state treasury.
Gabriel actually instructed his men not to kill everyone. They were ordered to spare Quakers, Methodists, and Frenchmen, because those groups were known to be sympathetic to abolition. They even planned to march under a silk flag that read, "Death or Liberty," a direct callback to Patrick Henry.
By late August, everything was in place. Hundreds, possibly thousands, of enslaved men across central Virginia knew the plan. The swords were sharpened. The targets were mapped out.
But on the afternoon of August 30th, just hours before the rebellion was supposed to begin, the sky turned black.
Virginia was hit by one of the most catastrophic thunderstorms in its history. It was a torrential biblical downpour.
The rain was so heavy that the creeks and rivers immediately flooded. Bridges connecting the countryside to Richmond were completely washed away. Roads turned into impassable swamps of deep mud.
There was no way for Gabriel's army to assemble. The men who tried to march couldn't cross the rivers. Gabriel was forced to send word out to delay the uprising until the next night.
But in any conspiracy, delay is the deadliest enemy. You cannot keep a secret among 1,000 people for very long.
On the morning of August 31st, two enslaved men named Pharaoh and Tom, who belonged to a planter named Mosby Shepherd, lost their nerve. The sheer scale of the plot terrified them, and they feared the brutal retaliation if it failed.
They went to Mosby Shepherd and confessed everything. They told him that a massive slave army was gathering to burn Richmond to the ground and kill the white population.
Shepherd immediately jumped on his horse and rode as fast as he could through the mud to the governor's mansion. He burst in and warned James Monroe.
Monroe did not hesitate. He called out the state militia, armed them with muskets, and put Richmond on total lockdown. He dispatched heavily armed cavalry patrols into the countryside to start rounding up suspects.
The element of surprise was gone. The rebellion was crushed before a single sword could be drawn.
A massive dragnet swept across Virginia. Dozens of enslaved men were arrested, thrown in chains, and dragged to the Richmond Penitentiary.
Gabriel, however, managed to escape. He slipped down to the Chickahominy River and managed to get a job working on a schooner called the Mary, which was sailing down to Norfolk.
For nearly a month, he evaded capture. But the state of Virginia put a massive $300 bounty on his head.
And tragically, Gabriel was ultimately betrayed by another enslaved man. A man named Isham, who worked on the docks in Norfolk, recognized Gabriel from the wanted posters. Isham turned him in, hoping to use the $300 reward to buy his own freedom.
The state of Virginia later paid Isham, but only gave him $50, cheating him out of the full reward.
Gabriel was transported back to Richmond in heavy iron chains. Governor James Monroe personally interviewed him, hoping to find out how far the conspiracy spread.
But Gabriel refused to speak. Monroe later wrote a letter to Thomas Jefferson saying, "From what he said to me, he seemed to have made up his mind to die and to have resolved to say but little on the subject of the conspiracy."
Over 70 enslaved men were put on trial. And we have to use the word trial very loosely.
These were courts of oyer and terminer. There was no jury, just a panel of 5 white justices. Enslaved people were not allowed to testify against white people, but they could testify against each other.
And it is during these trials that we get one of the most chilling, profound moments in American history.
One of the condemned conspirators, his exact name is lost to history, but he was standing before the judges, was asked if he had anything to say before he was sentenced to hang.
He looked at the judges, the men who had literally fought in the American Revolution just 20 years earlier, and he said,
"I have nothing more to offer than what General Washington would have had to offer had he been taken by the British and put to trial."
Let that sink in.
"I have adventured my life in endeavoring to obtain the liberty of my countrymen and am a willing sacrifice in their cause."
It was a mic drop moment. It completely shattered the Southern myth that enslaved people were happy and docile. This man was throwing the Declaration of Independence right back in their faces.
The Virginia courts showed no mercy. They sentenced 26 men to death by hanging. The executions were public, designed to spread terror.
Gabriel himself was hanged on October 10th, 1800, at the town gallows. He went to his death with complete stoicism, refusing to name any other conspirators.
But as the body count rose, even the white politicians started to get nervous about the optics. Governor James Monroe wrote to his friend, Thomas Jefferson, who was currently waiting to see if he would win the presidency.
Monroe asked Jefferson for advice. He essentially said, "We've hanged 2 dozen men. The public wants blood, but I'm worried we are going too far."
Jefferson wrote back a very revealing letter. He said, "The other states and the world at large will forever condemn us if we indulge a principle of revenge, or go one step beyond absolute necessity. They cannot lose sight of the rights of the two parties, and the object of the unsuccessful one."
Jefferson, who enslaved over 600 people in his lifetime, was quietly admitting that Gabriel had the moral high ground. He told Monroe, "Where shall we stop?"
Monroe halted the executions. Instead of hanging the remaining conspirators, the state of Virginia sold them down the river to the Deep South, or to sugar plantations in the Caribbean, which was essentially a slower death sentence.
The aftermath of Gabriel's rebellion changed the South forever.
Before 1800, there was a small but vocal abolitionist movement in Virginia. People like George Washington were freeing their slaves and their wills.
But after Gabriel's rebellion, the white planter class slammed the door shut. They were absolutely terrified. The Virginia legislature passed brutal new laws.
They severely restricted the hiring out of enslaved artisans. They made it illegal for enslaved people to gather in large groups after dark, even for church. They passed laws making it significantly harder for an enslaver to legally free an enslaved person.
And most importantly, they required any enslaved person who was freed to leave the state of Virginia within 12 months or face being re-enslaved. They wanted to eliminate the free black population entirely because they saw them as a dangerous influence.
Gabriel's rebellion failed to end slavery, but it proved that the desire for liberty wasn't limited to white men in powdered wigs. The spark of the American Revolution had caught fire in the slave cabins, and the South would spend the next 60 years living in terror of the day that fire could no longer be put out.
While Virginia was dealing with the fallout of the rebellion, Thomas Jefferson was finally settling into the president's house in Washington, and he was about to make a geopolitical gamble that would alter the shape of the planet.
Join us tomorrow for episode 57, The Louisiana Purchase. We step into the back rooms of Paris to witness a diplomatic miracle. Napoleon Bonaparte is broke, and Thomas Jefferson wants to buy a river. We watch as the United States accidentally buys half a continent for pennies on the acre.
I'm Stephen.
And I'm Leah.
You can find every episode at pointedwords.com. And this is our story.